WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American Television. This program is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today's Tuesday, May 23rd, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. We've got big news from Arizona on the election integrity front. The Arizona House and Senate just passed a resolution to ban electronic voting machines. The legislature says the resolution doesn't need to be approved by Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs to become law. Yesterday, State Senator Sonny Borelli sent a letter to all 15 Arizona counties telling them that they cannot use electronic voting machines in upcoming federal elections. Borelli said this in his press release, quote, "The legislature is exercising our plenary authority to see that no electronic voting systems in the state of Arizona are used as the primary method for conducting, counting, tabulating, or verifying federal elections unless those systems meet necessary standards of protection," end quote. The resolution specifies that any voting machine that uses foreign components does not meet the necessary standards. Here is State Senator Wendy Rogers explaining to Steve Bannon what the resolution does.
Senate Concurrent Resolution 1037 did not, I say again, did not require the governor to sign off. The House and the Senate voted on this. And what it does is it reclaims our state legislative's plenary power per the U.S. Constitution over federal elections. Not state elections, federal elections. And so this was transmitted once it got voted on out of the two chambers, not to the governor, but to the Secretary of State. And as such, the follow-up letter Borelli sent out this morning to the 15 counties essentially said, we are reclaiming our plenary authority. You are not to use machines in any way, shape, or form unless they can comply with strict criteria laid out in five pages of our Senate concurrent resolution.
Bannon then asked Rogers, what's going to happen when Governor Katie Hobbs and Secretary of State Adrian Fontes refuse to comply?
This is amazing. I take it that Katie Hobbs and the cartel lawyer that is currently the Secretary of State, they're just not going to sit there and go, hey, Gunny Borelli, Senator Rogers, this is amazing. Thank you. Why didn't we think of that? I assume they're going to go to court to try to have a showdown of who's actually in charge there. The state legislature as outlined in the Constitution of the United States or themselves?
Well, we'll see you in court if that's the case. Sonny and I have talked about this.
We'll certainly be keeping an eye on this. And staying on the election news front, Carrie Lake's 3 days in court ended on Friday, and on Monday, the judge issued his ruling. Lake's lawyers tried to prove that Maricopa County, the most voter-dense area of the state, failed to properly verify signatures on mail-in ballots during the 2022 Arizona gubernatorial election. Lake supposedly lost that election to Katie Hobbs by 17,000 votes. Lake's expert witnesses claimed that up to 344,000 ballots were flawed, far beyond the margin of victory. On Friday, her attorney, Kurt Olson, made these closing comments.
Approximately 274,000 ballots out of a 1.3 million cast were compared and the signature verified purportedly in less than 3 seconds a ballot. 70,000 in less than 2 seconds a ballot. That's not signature comparison.
Olson explained that those rates do not meet the state's legal standard for signature verification. Yesterday, Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Peter Thompson dismissed the former TV anchor's lawsuit, dealing Lake another blow. After the judge's decision, Lake tweeted, quote, "If you had something precious taken from you, how hard would you fight to save it? Good night, Arizona. Big news coming tomorrow," end quote. And last week, the world's first or second richest man, whichever he may be this week, said things that major influencers aren't supposed to say. First, Twitter chief Elon Musk said that he believed in conspiracies. Here he is schooling CNBC's David Faber on the topic.
You know, you do some tweets that seem to be, or at least give support to some who would call others conspiracy theories.
Well, yes, but I mean, honestly, you know, some of these conspiracy theories have turned out to be true.
Which ones?
Well, like the Hunter Biden laptop.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was a pretty big deal. There was Twitter and others engaged in active suppression of information that was relevant to the public. That's a terrible thing that happened. That's election interference.
But
next, Musk attacked George Soros, a violation that propagandists consider even greater than believing in conspiracy theories, although the two are certainly related. Musk tweeted that Soros reminded him of Magneto, the X-Men villain. This triggered a Twitter conversation, and Musk elaborated by saying that Soros wants to erode the very fabric of civilization. Soros is a hedge fund billionaire who uses his resources to destroy the Western world. He funds organizations that work to incite division and chaos, all for the ultimate purpose of eroding the fabric of society, just as Musk has observed. In addition to backing numerous destructive radical district attorneys, his Open Society Foundation's network has contributed tens of millions of dollars to initiatives and groups dedicated to defunding the police. He spent piles of money on influencing how elections are conducted, and he's used his resources to destroy borders all over the West. And that's just a footnoted version. When Faber brought up Elon's mean tweet about Soros, the EV tycoon stood his ground.
I mean, for example, even today, Elon, you tweeted this thing about George Soros. Well, I'm looking for it because I want to make sure I quote it properly. But, I mean, you know what you wrote. But you basically...
I said it reminds me of Magneto. It's just like, you know, calm down, people. This is not like made a pivotal case out of it.
You also... you said he wants to erode the very fabric of civilization and Soros hates humanity. Like, when you do something like that, do you
think
about...
Yeah, I think that's true. That's my opinion.
Okay. But why share it? Why share it? Especially because... I mean... Why share it when people who buy Teslas may not agree with you? Advertisers on Twitter may not agree with you. Why not just say, hey, I think this. You can tell me. We can talk about it over there. You can tell your friends. But why share it widely?
I mean, this is freedom of speech. I'm allowed to say what I want.
You absolutely are.
Elon's views on Soros drew out the minions in corporate media, who quickly went to work laying cover for Soros with headline after headline defending his honor. This is just another indicator that the power elite have lost their hold on the narrative. And joining me to discuss today's stories is conspiracy theorist and the New American senior editor, Rebecca Terrell. Hi, Rebecca. I hope you're not mad at me for calling you a conspiracy theorist.
Absolutely not. On the contrary, it's a badge of honor.
What do you make of all that? You know, they're still holding on to the conspiracy theory that the elections were fair. I don't think we're having such a hard time keeping up with all the conspiracy theories that turn out to be true. Elon, you know, he listed only two out of such a pile. What do you make of all these stories today?
Right, exactly. I think that that's a good point. He, you know, God bless him for what he's done. That's great for sticking up for free speech, even though it is odd that Twitter still does censor some people. So how does that fit, right? Yep. And maybe he's on the right path. Maybe he's got a little way to go before he fully embraces free speech. But, you know, there are so many other things that I think that he missed out. He missed the chance to say, like, let's look at what's going on. This is just one example of many that we could talk about. Let's look at what's going on at Target. In the stores, you walk in now and it's pride, 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 especially in the children's section. Children's clothing is, they have a pride toddler line of clothing in Target. There's a onesie that says Born Proud, and the swimsuits, the tags on them describe how they are, they have a light binding effect and they're made with tuck friendly construction on swimsuits for children and toddlers. Now, if we patronize the store, why is there not a huge, you know, hey, Elon, you could lead us on a huge Target boycott because without children and families, we are losing our culture. We are handing this over because right now it's Target. We're going to go to sleep. We're going to sit on this and not do anything about it. And tomorrow it's going to be everywhere because they're not going to stop. And this is just one of the things that George Soros is promoting. You know, let's look at all the riots and the Black Lives Matter and
Alameda
search. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, again, you know, maybe he was taken off guard, but Elon's a sharp cookie. I just feel like he could have gone a little bit farther than he did. I don't mean to be sound so harshly critical of him because he was going in the right direction.
Yeah. Right. But, I mean, Elon's a complicated guy. We've had this discussion off tape too, or off camera. You know, everyone's trying to figure out, is he for free speech? Is he not? You know, like you said, he sends out mixed signals, but it is good to see that. And maybe he sends out mixed signals because maybe he's a little mixed up. We don't know. You know, I'm sure at some point we'll do some profile on him anyway. What do you make of all the election? As we said off camera, you didn't hold out much hope for that judge and the ruling that was coming in Carrie Lake's lawsuit in the first place, huh? So this was to be expected from you.
Yeah, well, I think it's comical that the 3 days in court ended on Friday, and the judge, one of the last things he said was, I'm going to take special care in my ruling to avoid any chance of any appeal coming through. He said he's going to be just very meticulous. So media was speculating, we don't know if it's going to be days or weeks or even months before this judge makes a ruling in the case. He comes back on Monday morning and throws it out. He was the one who originally threw out her 7 cases that she filed.
No.
And they were all, she appealed to the, it went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled, no, you've got to hear this one because this one is about mail-in ballot signatures. And you've got to remember too, let's look at the 2005 Carter Baker Commission. What were their findings that to try to increase voter integrity? I'm just going to read a few. They had 87 recommendations, and here are some of them. Increase voter ID requirements, be leery of mail-in voting, halt ballot harvesting, maintain voter lists to ensure dead people are not included, to allow election observers to monitor ballot counting and to make sure voting machines are working properly. You know, those are all, that's like a list of things that are going wrong now. Yeah. And have been going wrong because that was 2005. They were looking at historical information there. So this has been going on for a long time. There's nothing conspiracy theory about it, unless you want to call Jimmy Carter and James Baker conspiracy theorists.
Yeah. Yeah. And, it is interesting to see that what the legislature in Arizona is doing. The legislature is saying we have absolute power to do this. I'm with Steve Bannon on the fact that I just don't see the Secretary of State, and I don't see Katie Hobbs being like, "Well, you got us." You know, I just don't see it. You know, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that the legislature is living up to its responsibility in doing this. There's a little loophole, unless the voting machines adhere to certain protocols, certain standards. And I'm like, no. Don't leave that loophole, because the voting machines have been, we know this from before the 2020 election. I'm not talking about the 2020 election. We know from DEF CON, the hackers conference out in Vegas every year, and they've been warning for years, hey, we let our hackers who know nothing about election machines in, and within a day, every one of them had hacked them. They've been warning about all these vulnerabilities. Even prior to the 2020 election, it was Democrats mostly who were calling on, we need to stop using these voting machines, they're too vulnerable to fraud. And now, since they've worked in their,
control of them, yeah,
exactly.
I hope that goes through, because you never know. I mean, it could be that it could come down to Arizona, and they're really fighting down there. Of course, we have John Birch Society members. You know, they're involved in election integrity work and trying to restore that, and that should be something that happens all over the country, of course. But, you know, going back to all of that, any other thoughts as far as all these stories working together? Because it does seem like the narrative is falling apart, you know, and this is something that I've been working on for the New American Sooner. I'm going to write something about it. It's like, it seems like everywhere you turn, They just can't, you know, it's like they're, what is it, like whack-a-mole. Everyone's always coming out with something that they're not supposed to say. And, you know, they keep trying to move him out of the way. They keep trying to hush him up. They keep trying to shame him. And that doesn't seem to be working. What are your thoughts as far as that, them losing the narrative on pretty much everything, it seems like?
Well, my comments to conservatives is welcome to the real world. We know that old adage, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. And I think that, you know, they say the only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. We've been doing nothing for too long. And here in the Birch Society, we do have the action plan to take our country back. And we just encourage everyone to join the John Birch Society and get boots on the ground.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'd add to that, you know, if you have any questions about the John Birch Society, we're going to go shameless plug here. You go jbs.org and we have action. You can look at our action project or how to get involved. If you're not part of a chapter, you can put your zip code in, find out the nearest coordinator and whatnot. And I'm going to add to this another tier to the shameless plug. It's like we've been on top of this stuff for not just years, but decades. So, you know, it's time to get on board and it's time to restore this nation. Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Paul.
And stay tuned, folks, because after this, we'll be talking to a special guest who's fighting to make sure that his teenage daughter's death by homicidal COVID protocols wasn't in vain. We'll be right back.
You remember when everyone bought all the toilet paper? And they wanted me to wear these things? And someone invested a lot of money into this stuff. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
Being informed is important, but being informed with the truth is essential. Visit thenewamerican.com for news you can trust.
Welcome back. So we at the New American are excited to cover the World Council on Health's The Better Way Conference in Bath, UK. TNA senior editor Veronica Karolinko will be there reporting live, and she'll be hosting two panel discussions. Please visit betterwayconference.org to get your tickets. Now to the rest of our show. Breaking the Oath is a new documentary by America First Productions, a project of the Patriot Review podcast host, Jeff Wagner. It's a story about Grace Shera, a Wisconsin teen who lost her life in 2021 in a COVID hospital. Her grieving parents and older sister reveal why they think Grace and millions like her have been murdered by government-dictated hospital protocols.
After we watched our daughter Grace die on FaceTime, I immediately felt that I needed to go to the hospital, though I was still pretty sick. And I met Jessica and our pastor there. And while we were in the room, Jessica and I had spent a few moments just with Grace alone. And it was just a horrific sight to come upon was the fact that her daughter Grace was now gone. The emotions that came over the top of our minds and just our physical bodies were just unbelief. We took her BiPAP off. It was still on. This was hope and prayers that somehow she wasn't really gone. And as soon as we did that, the color of Grace changed, and we had to accept that she was truly gone.
Not one person stepped foot in that room. How can you do that? How can you allow an innocent person, a child? She's only 19 years old. die in front of your eyes. You don't do that. If you're human, you don't do that.
They knew they weren't going to convince us to put Grace on a ventilator. That means the money was going to dry up. They had to have the money. And when you follow the money trail all the way through, you see that a ventilator is about a $300,000 decision, that they had higher paying patients in the emergency room. Grace was worth more dead than alive.
Scott Shara, better known as Grace's dad, calculates that hospitals have been receiving incentives of more than $300,000 per patient thanks to systems established by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and the CARES Act, which stands for Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security. So joining us to discuss the documentary and the groundbreaking lawsuit he has filed against the hospital is Scott Shara. Welcome, Scott.
Well, thanks for having me, Paul. It's good to be here.
Does that tear you up every time you see that?
That's tough. That is very tough to watch.
I mean, we've been following closely what you've been doing, and it's crazy. It's admirable. You call this in your one of your vaccine death reports, you call this the greatest organized mass murder in the history of our world. In your documentary, you lay it out in chapters how this is about a bigger scheme. This is an elaborate scheme that ultimately comes down to depopulation. Does that sound right?
You knocked it out of the park with that description. Yes, I think it's exactly that. And you know, one of the people who's opened my eyes to that reality is Vera Sherov, the Holocaust survivor that I've been doing interviews with. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you hear her frame this, what her concern is, you know, we're at the tipping point. Because this time there's no one to come in and rescue because they're all in on it. And just drilling it down to a specific so people can get their arms around this, right now there is a concerted effort to frame everything that's been happening as the COVID chapter so then they can turn the page and start phase two. So when you hear, for example, Tom Renz came out last week and said, we need a congressional hearing on these hospital murders. Well, that will never work because Congress is part of the problem. And I can prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt. On March 23rd of 2010, Obamacare was passed. We've had a chance to repeal Obamacare. Why don't they repeal it? And read page 141 of Obamacare. It's 974 pages long. Page 141 is section 1553. And the title of section 1553 is Prohibition Against Discrimination on Assisted Suicide. And it goes on to explain that we are going to kill you by assisted suicide, euthanasia, and mercy killing. But if there's a doctor or hospital system that doesn't want to follow the game plan, you can't be discriminated against. What's very interesting about that is subsection D of that section says that if you are discriminated against, your appeal is with the Secretary of Health and Human Services, which that man is likely the most corrupt man on the planet. He's the one solely responsible for implementing the public health emergency ongoing for 39 months in a row.
Yeah. Well, he's no longer there. You're talking about Fauci, right?
No, oh, I'm talking about
Francis Collins?
No, it's Xavier Barak.
Oh, yes.
I can't pronounce the last name, of course. But yeah, I mean, you can't make that stuff up. But when you see the paper, you know, and this is what's been happening since I've become a full-time advocate. You start researching, and then you find these documents, and then you read them with your own eyes. You can't unsee that. Mm. And you wish you could show it to the entire world so that they could wake up, because that's what's holding us back. There's not enough people woken up.
Now, Grace had, she had
Down syndrome.
Yeah, she had Down syndrome. Yep. So one of the things that you suggest or you believe happened is this aspect of the depopulation agenda includes taking out what they call, I believe, undesirables, right? So yep. Is this where she felt?
She was definitely an undesirable in that standard. I'm going to pull that up. So Ezekiel Emanuel, I won't pull it up here, but Ezekiel Emanuel is the chief architect of Obamacare, and his mindset He said it publicly in 1996, and this is all the way through Obamacare, is once you become a non-contributing member of society, you do not deserve medical care. So I was asked, this is right after the lawsuit dropped, a reporter called me, and as we were on the discussion, she said, are you a conspiracy theorist? Because she was asking me, do you think that Grace was killed because she had Down syndrome? I said, yes, I do. And then she asked, are you a conspiracy theorist? And so then I sent her some documents, and I walked through them with her, and I could hear her waking up over the phone. I said, because I can prove it. Yeah. So at first I thought this because in the doctor's reports that were written for the 7 days Grace was in the hospital, they referenced that she had Down syndrome 36 different times.
Yeah, and you're like, why?
What's the point? Doesn't make any sense. Well, then we found in our research a document from the Palliative Care Network of Wisconsin that specifically calls out how to kill Down syndrome people. So this is how they train.
Well, how do they frame it?
Yeah, they frame it this way. So this is a document. It's titled Palliative Care for Patients with Down Syndrome. It's written by two MDs. This is a training document for other doctors and nurses. So first, they don't say anything. They introduce the concept of Down syndrome, and they list about 40 complications that Down syndrome people have. And so they have congenital cardiac septal defects, thyroid dysfunction, dental issues, sleep apnea. It goes on and on. So you just look at this, oh my gosh, these people are nothing but problems, right? Mm-hmm. That's how they introduce the document. Then they make a transition statement. In the transition statement, I'm quoting here, it says the lifelong toll on families is high. So they're framing this that, okay, these
people. Oh, this was a burden on you.
Yes, these people are a burden on their families. Part of a robust plan of care includes acknowledgement of this toll by healthcare workers. So now they set it up that these people are a pain, the families don't want them, and the healthcare workers need to acknowledge this. Well, then they set up the killing statement. And this is how they do it. This is the training. These medical professionals have been trained in the spirit of collectivism, not individualism. So the idea of the Hippocratic Oath is based on individualism. Yeah. Collectivism says we need to attenuate care. So here's the killing statement. Whenever possible, decision makers for people with Down syndrome, that's the medical people, should be encouraged.
They're the decision maker? Okay.
Yeah. So this is for the doctors. They should be encouraged to use substituted judgment to make key palliative care decisions. All efforts should be made to determine the preferences of the patient. However, because of lifelong cognitive impairment, the views of the person with Down syndrome may not be known. So think through, I mean, that's as much of a smoking.
So if she wants to live, she doesn't know what she
doesn't
does.
Know that she'd want to live.
Yeah, that's insane. You've obviously done so much research, and you know, going back to, obviously, in the last segment, we touched on conspiracy theories. What a weird thing to ask you. Like, what does that have to do with anything? Like, if you're a reporter, and I was a reporter, you know, it's like, that's not a question. Are you a conspiracy theorist? What's the substance here? You want to ask about the substance here. And so I don't, you know, that just proves the conditioning that is happening all over, you know? And so your documentary dropped. You've been a man on a mission. And, you know, we've talked before we got in here. You are driven. And so how has the response been to it? And what are you hoping to get out of it?
Well, those are great questions. So the documentary premiered in a local theater in De Pere, Wisconsin on Sunday afternoon, and it was packed. It was a tearjerker to watch that live with a crowd, and you know, they're clapping during parts and the tears are flowing during parts, and just to be part of that. And then we did Q&A afterward. It was phenomenal.
Everyone involved in the movie did Q&A, is my understanding.
Yes, yeah. And so then last night we did, and so that was the people local who were in the De Pere Theater. So our family, obviously, and then Robert Pazer and his mom, who we rescued in November. You guys did an article on him.
Yeah.
And then last night we did another live one online, and then the entire cast was there, including Nurse Erin and Vera. So that was really neat to get everybody's take on that. So now it's dropped on Rumble. So it's
you know, we're gonna be doing it. People can watch it.
Yeah,
now
they can watch it on Rumble. We're doing a press release tomorrow, and so you said, what are we hoping to have happen? The same thing that we started this campaign with is waking people up, so physically and spiritually. So physically, you know, if you think through, if you don't believe that hospitals have become the new killing fields, you're going to fall trap to Obamacare and Ezekiel Emanuel's weaving his...
Well, you break it down in the documentary. You do a pretty good job. You break it down. Well, thank you, Scott. Who's Sean? Thank you, Scott, so much. And folks, we're actually going to have an interview that Rebecca did with Scott right after this. For right now, that's it for our news segment. And like we say, for more Truth Behind the News, make sure to get a subscription to the New American Magazine at thenewamerican.com, or you can call our office at 800-727-8783. And like we said, stay tuned, because Scott and Rebecca will be talking more about Scott's lawsuit and his daughter's, you know, that was triggered by his daughter's death. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Brandon House. Does your family have an emergency freeze-dried food supply on hand? With all that's going on in the world today, why would you not? We have attacks on our power grid, our banking system. We have the actual threat of a banking collapse. Of course, people are talking World War III, chemical spills, and so much more. I've had an emergency freeze-dried food supply on hand for my family since 2013, and then we began offering it to our audience as a service to them, but it's also a big part of our general operating budget. So thank you for purchasing it from us. We can help you, and you can help us. We all win. So let me tell you about it. You can order it right now and get free freight. We're offering free freight. For some of you, that's going to save you hundreds of dollars, because you're ordering a one-year supply and a two-year supply, and we're offering free freight. So you can order it at WVWTVstore.com. That's WVWTVstore.com. You can also call and talk to someone over the phone, and they'll answer all your questions and take your order, track it all the way to your front door. That number is 901-468-9357. We have the gluten-free kit right here available, and it comes in the individual pouches of the individual entrees. Easy to make, easy instructions to follow. We have a 3-month, 6-month, 1-year, 2-year mega protein kit with real meat and the ultimate breakfast program as well. All the details, WVWTVstore.com. It has a 25-year shelf life, as I said, but we offer more than just freeze-dried food. We offer also emergency supplies. We've thought about the things you're going to need should the power go out or there's a crisis, like a little stove. All you need is a little bit of kindling, start a fire, use that stove, and then the custom pot goes on top to boil the water. We also have the water purifiers, as well as hand crank and solar radios and flashlights. Everything's available for you to check out now at WVWTVstore.com or using the number on our screen. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rebecca Terrell with the New American Magazine, and back today with me in the spotlight is Scott Shera, best known as Grace's dad. He lost his daughter in 2021 in a COVID hospital, and now he works to make sure others do not share his fate. Scott, welcome back. It's great to see you.
Well, that was a very nice, succinct open. Great to see you too.
Well, you filed your groundbreaking lawsuit in Wisconsin last month that seeks justice not only for Grace, but for anyone adversely affected by our healthcare system, which I use the term healthcare loosely in that respect. But the hospital involved in the case filed its response to your suit on May 15th. What can you tell us about it?
Well, just to give a little bit of context to the entire lawsuit. So on March 30th is when we did a press conference, and the purpose of the press conference was to launch the suit. And specifically that day, we had to file a request for mediation with the director of state courts in Madison. And this is a step that's required in Wisconsin, strangely, but you know, what is the main barrier to even file are all the state laws. Mm-hmm. So it is really an exception to file a medical malpractice type case, wrongful death type case, where hospitals and doctors are involved, because the state laws preclude you from filing. In Grace's case, she was a legal adult, and because of that, we had to open up an estate to file. And the amount of money is near zero that you can receive. So attorneys don't want to take the cases on. So we ended up, you know, of course, we're funding our own case, which I think you already knew. But
sure.
You know, that's why you don't see, you know, there's virtually no other lawsuits filed during this supposed COVID era. So then, you know, just to get us to when the hospital responded on May 15th, so then we filed our civil case, because we had to file the request for mediation first, that hoop. Then the civil case got filed April 11th. Then the hospital, the five nurses, two doc, hospital, five doctors, two nurses, all were served on April 25th, which then 20 days by state statute, they had to respond, which was May 15th. So that's why the hospital responded, because they had to. They finally had to respond. And it, what's interesting about their response is a couple of things. One is you said healthcare loosely, which is real interesting, because I'm going to read right from their response. So they have a thing called affirmative defenses. So they virtually denied the 100 plus items that we had in the summons and complaint, but then they have affirmative defenses. Affirmative defense number 17 says, plaintiff has failed to state a claim for relief against Ascension Health, as it is not a proper party to this lawsuit. It does not provide healthcare services. So process that.
Ascension Healthcare does not provide healthcare services.
Yeah, which, you know, of course, my warped sense of humor says, well, yeah, I knew that. They provide death care services. So, you know, it's...
Ouch.
Yeah, well, I mean, just think that through. But these are the legal shenanigans that happen. You know, it's been longstanding. Everybody knows in a lawsuit, the only people that make money are the attorneys. Well, this is exactly it. The Wisconsin attorney we had said, Scott, you know, there's going to be file cabinets full of these foolish things that happen. And, you know, we just have to keep going through with our plan of attack. Then another.
Can I give you a rationale to that? We don't provide healthcare services. What is there any further explanation there?
Well, it goes on in the. Yeah, that's a great question. It goes on. It says, it, which is Ascension Health, does not employ healthcare providers, nor did it employ anyone who rendered care to Gray Shear at any time period, including but not limited to any of the defendants in this action, which of course are the five doctors and two nurses.
Are they denying that she was in the hospital at that time?
No, they're not. But this, you know, they set up different LLCs and corporations all for legal protection. So, you know, presumably, you know, you've got a doctor who might be on, it might be a service corporation. So they hire the doctor as a service corporation. So, I mean, this is, you know, they can't get out of a lawsuit because of this, obviously, but they throw this stuff out. And, you know, when you read it, word for word, they look like fools. Here's one that's even worse. So this is affirmative defense number six. Any and all injuries or damages sustained by plaintiffs, so the two plaintiffs in this case are me and Grace's estate, may be a direct and proximate result of the negligence and or decisions made by the plaintiffs. So, really? You know, the simple way to say that, you know, when I read it, I thought, oh yeah, Grace caused her own death. Right. So, you know, again, my warped sense of humor. So, yes, I mean, we did the negligence on the behalf of the plaintiff. Me specifically was checking my daughter into a killing field. Yes, that was my mistake. And, you know, I've repented for that. And I will never.
Well, you didn't know.
Well, sure, I didn't know. But what the reason I repented wasn't for the action. It was for the fear that was behind the action. You know, the propaganda had influenced my mind for, you know, my critical thinking, and, you know, that fear ultimately landed Grace into the hospital, and, you know, she's not here because of that.
That same thing can be said for a lot of people. You know, you distrust yourself and you trust the white coat, as you've said. So, okay, so, but that's not all. How this was, what, 64, this was a very long document that the healthcare system did. Yes. Did you hear back from the individual doctors and the individual nurses? Did they respond, or was that all part of this one response?
Yeah, there were several responses. So we received, the hospital responded on behalf of the hospital and the two nurses, and they claimed that we can't sue the nurses, which is also ridiculous. Two of the doctors individually responded, and then three doctors had the same lawyer respond on their behalf. So we received one, two, three, four different responses. Essentially, all of them are denying that they did anything wrong. There's a number of dismissals, you know, which we expect. You know, so the legal team is fully aware that this is going to happen. It's not a surprise, but, you know, what I'm more surprised than than this type of response. You know, they prepared me, which is good, because you read this stuff through and you think, oh my gosh, what the heck is going on here? But you know, we have a great team. They prepared me for that. But what I was really shocked at isn't even the responses. It was that the local news. So when for example, we did our press conference, the local news, the local Fox affiliate really covered the press conference well. And then they did what they should do, which is reach out to St. Elizabeth's. Do you have any comment? Yeah. And then they, you know, they wouldn't return the call. Yeah. Well, with this, they picked up on this, you know, it's a public filing. So I'm guessing they have somebody that is monitoring Grace's file at Outagamie County in Wisconsin. And so as soon as this was filed, they did a report on it, but they never called me. You know, like they extended the courtesy to St. Elizabeth's with right. our accusation, but now their counter, they don't, hmm. you know, they don't contact me.
And then interesting.
What our what the attorneys were, you know, at least a little bit shocked of, but I mean, they realized that Ascension would also be picking up quite a risky position. But I mean, you know, I've been out there for already, you know, 17 months. I've been on over 500 interviews, and I'm calling it what happened to Grace what it is, which it is murder. And so you would expect that they would countersue me for, right?
For defamation or
defamation. Right. Exactly. And, you know, so why don't they do that? Come on. What are you really saying? If right. you don't countersue me, what you're saying is that you know what happened.
Do you have any idea? I'm sorry. Yeah. Right. You've got your billboard campaign all over that area of Wisconsin, and you like, yes, you've become quite a celebrity in this arena of hospital protocols, deadly hospital protocols. And you yourself have participated in a hospital rescue. So yeah, you're making a name for yourself and you're seen as a hero by many. But I want to circle back to them blaming Grace for her own death. What's the rationale there? It makes as much sense as blaming you for her death. But
yeah, well, that one doesn't have any explanation. I mean, it ends where I ended reading. It ends. I'll just read it again. Any and all injuries or damages sustained by plaintiffs may be a direct and proximate result of the negligence and or decisions made by the plaintiffs.
Wow.
You know, there was, you know, why I get frustrated with a statement like that is because they went out of their way to not provide us informed consent.
Right.
So if they provided informed consent and then we didn't take their recommendations, I could see, okay, well, that, you know, they could sure. have a leg to stand on here. But the only two things that I can imagine that this relates to are, number one, Grace was not vaccinated. And if you might remember way back when you and I talked, one of the first times I pointed out the COVID expert who wrote his report for the first day that Grace was in the hospital said that she likely would not be here if she'd been vaccinated. So they had a bias toward Grace because she was unvaccinated. So, I mean, it could be that angle. Then the other angle is, you know, we denied their desire for us to give a pre-authorization for a ventilator.
Right.
So, you know, they admitted Grace never needed a ventilator. Okay. They just wanted to have this in their back pocket.
Right.
But you realize in the scheme of things, they're going to be throwing as much up against the wall as they can and seeing what sticks. So, you know, the fact is we chose to not give them a pre-authorization for a ventilator. I talked with the doctor the morning after Grace was murdered and asked him at that point, if we would have approved a ventilator, would Grace's life been saved? And he said, no. So,
really?
You know, so there was no need for a ventilator. I mean, if they use that as the excuse, I'd love that, because that would allow us to bring up in the discovery process all the statistics relative to people being killed on ventilators. You know, right. A ventilator would not have saved Grace's life. It would have deferred her death. So they would have made more money.
I wonder if they'll even use the fact that they had to kick you out of the hospital. Of course, that was on a, I think that the pretext seems very silly, especially because you were acting as her, since she had Down syndrome, you were acting as her advocate in the hospital. And
and on top of that, they prevented us from having a replacement advocate in for 47 hours.
Right.
So, all these things.
Everything just points to, wait, what's going on here? Because, I mean, this totally violated, as you know, Scott, I have a background in nursing. I don't practice anymore, obviously, but this is a basic principle of ethics, medical ethics, the autonomy that you're supposed to grant patients, the fact that you're not supposed to do any harm. You know, these are basic principles that don't, you know, like they said that, I think one of the things that your outfit put out was that, summarizing Ascension's claims, that nurses and hospitals have no duty to obtain a patient's medical informed consent under Wisconsin law.
Right.
Doesn't take state law. This is basic principles of medical ethics.
Yeah, I can read that one. So this is affirmative defense number 13. So where the team got all this stuff from was from this response. Okay. And there's similar affirmative defenses in the other responses, but this one is the most egregious because Ascension Hospital is the one who is standing behind this one. So this is number 13. It says the claims in this case are subject to the exceptions to informed consent set forth in Wisconsin Statute 448.30. I've read 448.30.
Right. What does it say?
I'll read 448.30, informed consent. Any physician who treats a patient shall inform the patient about the availability of reasonable alternative medical modes of treatment and about the benefits and risks of these treatments. The reasonable physician standard is the standard of informing a patient under this section. The reasonable physician standard requires disclosure only of information that a reasonable physician in the same or similar medical facility would know and disclose under the circumstances. So, there's absolutely no reason that we would not have gotten informed consent. We didn't know she was on Precedex. We didn't know that they were going to use lorazepam. I'll give you an example of how they did informed consent relative to morphine. So we had no idea. The doctor called Cindy and I at home. He had given Grace morphine at 6:15 p.m. At 6:43, he called us and said, Grace had another good day. I just gave her morphine. Okay, well, wow. Does that sound like informed consent? So then we're still trusting the white coat.
Right. If she had a good day, why did she need the morphine? There are all sorts of questions.
And we asked. But I'm still trusting the doctor at this point.
Right.
So I said, what's the reason you gave her morphine? He said, I needed to slow her breathing down. So I mean, we're not to think, okay, well, I mean, you're the doctor, right? I mean, this is the fundamental flaw that we all are under, and that's why I can't talk about this enough. We trust the white coat, and if you do that, whatever they do, you kind of just go along with, and they may or may not tell you what they did after the fact. Well, I mean, Grace died 45 minutes after that.
Yeah, that's tragic. Oh my word. And when I want to encourage everybody, I've just mentioned graceshera.com. That is Scott's website where you can keep getting updates about this case as it progresses. But there is a wonderful video on there. Well, besides the press conference where you announced the lawsuit, you can view that press conference there. But the video is, what's the title of it, Scott? Who was Grace?
Yeah, the video. So that one was done by the Highwire back a little over a year ago. And that's a tearjerker. That's very hard for me to watch.
Tearjerker. If you don't cry when you watch that, I just don't think you could have a soul. But it does. It tells the story, and it tells it so well, just within a little 10-minute period. Just so tragic. But I want to point out too, your organization has also brought out that, for instance, Wisconsin Democrat U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin has criticized Ascension Health too in a recent letter to that company's CEO. Can you talk to that?
Yeah, so Ascension has a lot of black marks against it. And so I'll frame Tammy Baldwin's comment in terms of Ascension Hospital System is the largest Catholic hospital system in the United States. They're the second largest nonprofit in the United States. They have long been known for cost cutting to increase their profitability. They have $30 billion in cash. $30 billion in cash. Wow. Their CEO makes $13 million a year. And their standard that they use for care, I mean, that's what Tammy Baldwin was calling out, is you have terrible care and you're cost cutting and you're, you know, it obvious your goal is to increase profits versus taking care of the patient. You know, they're not the only one. She happened to be calling out Ascension, but you know, some of the research that I had uncovered early on when I started researching Ascension was they're in bed with George Soros in investment funds. That's a pretty strange bedfellow. During the first year of COVID, I had done the math. You know, you may remember this when you were interviewing me early on, and I did the math that showed that they received $10 billion in government bonus payments in the first year of COVID. You know, so this organization, just as an organization, has quite a, there's some skeletons. There's some bad behavior. The Milwaukee Journal in Wisconsin has also done some fairly major reporting on their lack of care. You know, multiple people have experienced bad situations with Ascension Hospital System.
Well, and even the New York Times, which is not exactly what you would call a conservative outfit, published an expose last year criticizing harshly. I mean, it was just scathing review of Ascension Health and how it does seems to operate like a Wall Street firm rather than a nonprofit that exists for the public good. So I'm curious though, and you might not be able to answer this question because of the case going on at this time. Did your attorneys have a favorable response to, did they receive that response from Ascension with, what was their attitude? I guess I should say.
It was surprisingly favorable. I mean, I didn't know what to think because I had I've never been involved before, right? So you get this stuff and, you know, I spent the morning of the 16th, I spent a couple hours reviewing all these things and you think, my gosh, this is going to be quite a, you know, for your first reaction is the guy paying for the bills. Like, this is going to be quite a bill responding to all of this, right? But then, you know, I talked with the attorneys later on in the day, and the Wisconsin attorney, he was so favorable. He thought that the Fox News coverage, he thought that somebody I knew at Fox did it. He said that's how favorable he thought that wasn't. Of course, I don't know anybody. I'm just the dad. And because they picked the things that make them, you know, the idea that Grace caused her own death. I mean, that's what they made they emphasized that point in the news coverage. It's like, you know. And a friend of mine even texted me, he said, oh, you made the news again. I said, well, what did you see? He said, well, Grace caused her own death. And, you know, I hadn't seen anything at that point. And, but anyway, the attorneys all looked at it as favorable.
Well, good. Well, that's a good sign. Well, again, I want to encourage everybody to visit graceshera.com, sign up for updates so you can keep track of this case. We'll, of course, be keeping track of it at thenewamerican.com. And I also want to mention your original website, ouramazinggrace.net, which has pretty much everything, right? That's where you catalog everything. And it's a beautiful site. I love perusing the pictures of Grace and getting to meet her now that she's gone, getting to at least meet her in that way. Is there anything else that people should know about how to get in touch with you? We'll of course put all of these links down below in the description for this video.
Yeah. Great question. You know, the reason we started the graceshera.com is because we see as this case proceeds that we're going to have multiple calls to action. So you know, people are always asking, what can we do to help? What can we do to help? And the specific thing is to enter your name and email. So when you go to that website, there's a pop-up screen, just enter your name and email. So that way we have a way to get a hold of you once there's a call to action. I don't know exactly what that looks like right now. You know, I'm envisioning that we're going to be able to fundraise for some other cases because we need to get some more cases filed, not us literally, but I mean, the people don't have the money to file the cases and the attorneys aren't taking them on unless they get paid. So in order to get more cases, we're going to have to fundraise. And so that's one thing. You know, there may be some legislative calls to action that could help us, not just in Wisconsin, but federally to we're in the hospital murder lane, and we've got to expose this on a national basis in order to stop the behavior. So those are the type of calls to action I'm seeing down the road. And in order to do that, we've got to get, you know, we need a couple hundred thousand people following the story.
Right, exactly. Well, Scott, thank you so much for your time today. I know how overwhelmed you are with all of this, but you're doing a wonderful job, and we certainly applaud you, and we'll continue praying.
Well, that's another thing people can do. I know people are doing that because, you know, we haven't had any death threats yet. And I think it's because of God's protection from the result of everybody praying. So I appreciate that very much.
Absolutely. Well, God bless, and we'll see you soon.
I certainly would not want a constitutional convention. I mean, whoa. Who knows what would come out of that?
Just imagine if we have a constitutional convention, the number of people who will be unhappy and the number of people who say the results are not valid, and then they'll just ignore the entire Constitution.
What we need are just more people that would read the one we have.
It isn't the Constitution that's the problem. It is the people who ignore the Constitution that usurp power and abuse the constitutional power that they ostensibly have.
If you can't enforce an existing piece of paper, how are you going to enforce a piece of paper that has a little more writing to it? In other words, it's been amended.
It's up to us to hold our elected officials accountable.
What can you do to elect good representatives and senators in your state legislature who understand the Constitution and are willing to take a stand?
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.
I'm Brandon House. At WVWTVstore.com, we don't only have emergency freeze-dried food, we have emergency supplies like an EMT trauma bag. If you have a nurse or a doctor or a nurse practitioner in your area and there's an emergency, they might be able to help you, but they may not have the supplies. So for my family, I have an EMT trauma bag on hand at all times. I also have this emergency stove. It allows for us not only to have heat in a 200 square foot area, but it is self-powered by the heat itself. It comes with liquid fuel, 3 containers of liquid fuel, and it will also be used as a stove. I can take the top off and use it to boil water and make freeze-dried food. We also have a sutures kit. We have blood clot. We also have potassium iodide that you need to protect your thyroid in the event of a nuclear catastrophe. Our government's ordered millions of dollars of such medications. Why? Check it all out. WVW TV Store. Hello, I'm Brandon House, and the MyPillow 2.0 is now available. This has new cooling technology that was not available